You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline
Kilburn. Hello, everyone. Beautiful day. Oh, what a beautiful day. This is on the Friday. It's a beautiful day. I can't guarantee Monday.
We can't
Monday.
Guarantee what it's going to be on Monday. That's no. True. That's true. That is a reminder that we are rebroadcast at 8 a.m. Monday morning, and also that you can listen online at KRUUFM.com at the live stream. What have you been reading this week, Mom?
Well, you know what? I haven't been reading a lot. I'm reading ahead for our programs coming up. There's
one about
talking to animals that is just I just can't put it down. It's really fascinating.
We've got some real exciting guests coming up.
Yeah, we really do.
Yeah. Next week we're interviewing an author who wrote a book about Mrs. Lincoln.
Yes.
Yeah, a biography of Mrs. Lincoln. Now, our guest today has been called by book publishers the best book cover designer in the country.
Whoa.
A master at designing book covers that sell, a creative person's dream to work with, and even a lucky charm. I don't see any pointy ears there, but George Foster has designed the cover for more than 1,000 books for publishers large and small, including Simon & Schuster, Harcourt Brace, Pearson Education, St. Martin's Press, and the early books in the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. He also wrote the book on book cover design. He wrote the chapter on book cover design in the perennial bestseller 1001 Ways to Market Your Books, and will be featured in a new book to be published later this year, The Writer's Essential Toolbox. Welcome to Writer's Voices, George.
Thank you, Monica.
Well, there's no doubt that a cover can be the draw for a book. There's no doubt about that in my mind.
It's kind of been proven, you know. It's the content of the book that really, really matters. It's a book.
Right.
But packaging the book is, you know, it becomes a book when it's packaged. Until then, it's a manuscript, really.
That's true. Yeah, sure.
And no matter how many times we hear, don't judge a book by a cover, guess what?
We do.
I do.
There actually this week has been a really interesting international example of that. I don't know how many of you have heard about this woman, Susan Boyle. Yeah, mm-hmm. A Scottish woman who...
Who
sang on a British TV and knocked everybody's socks off because no one expected her to be able to sing like an angel because she didn't look the part.
No.
And
you know, she can't even look up. I saw her last night.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on the news.
She's very, very shy.
Very shy. She just, you know, she looks down. And, she lived with her mother her whole life, took care of her mother until she died. And she's just,
I think part of her popularity and part of why people have been so excited is that fact that it drives that lesson home that we shouldn't judge people based just on appearances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Paul Potts was another one who won that, and he was a tenor that had a fantastic voice, and he was cell phone salesman, and they didn't expect him to, and, you know, they're sitting there like this, you know.
But so your job is to actually make the cover something that matches what's inside the book.
Well, yes. Taking Paul Potts, for example, he had mousy kind of receding kind of a look about him. And then when they signed him after that win, then they start dressing him up, put a tuxedo on him and all these things. So that's part of the story, that's all.
If
you want to be a best-kept secret, that's your choice. But if you want to get pushed out front and appeal to the widest possible demographic, then you just have to dress up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you first get started designing book covers?
I was born in Ohio.
Okay.
It was a dark and stormy night. Well, actually, it goes way back. I mean, I've been an artist my whole life. I started drawing at age 5 and got a lot of encouragement and actually won an award when I was like 6 or something. So I got a lot of encouragement and stuck with it. and then went to art school. And then after art school, I stuck with this sort of thing, did art, graphic design.
Uh-huh.
And it took a little while. And the I was working for myself as a graphic designer for maybe 10 years, and then realized that I had done some book covers, and I really liked it. And I was thinking, what would I do next? I mean, I was doing everything for everyone, any kind of a job, a logo or a menu or an ad or whatever. And there's someone who lived in town. He's since moved away, John Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
You may know John. And anyone who doesn't know John should know him. He's got a great book and a great consulting
And his
service.
Book is the one that we mentioned it's before, 1001 Ways
to
Market,
yeah.
Your Books. And also he was a contributing author to the book that we discussed last week,
mm-hmm.
with Thomas Gates, the book about Thank God I...
Oh, John, is John in that
John's
too?
In that too.
Oh, awesome. That'll be quite a book. Actually, my wife Mary is a contributing author.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Thomas mentioned that too. Well, maybe we can get Mary on the air here for a few minutes to discuss her contribution to that in a little bit later.
That would be great. Well, anyway, I guess to bring us up to the present, I discovered book covers as a passion. I talked to John and said, look, how can I do more of this? And he gave me some advice, and one thing led to the other, and starting around 93 maybe, I've been focusing on that and doing more every year, and it's become really my thing. It's been really my thing totally for about maybe 10 or however many years that's been.
Your speciality.
Yeah. And it's very engaging because, you know, art is a wide lens. It includes writing. Writing mm-hmm. is such an art. It's such an abstract art that you can take the abstraction of the alphabet and create feelings and images and amazing experiences, really, indelible experiences by just arranging characters of the alphabet for people. And so it's a big job. I take it very seriously about cover design, that you want to somehow give that experience, that kind of dignity and that kind of attractability, so that's, you know, the biggest shame for me is a really great book that just sits in a box.
In somebody's mm-hmm. garage.
Yeah, or a basement. Yeah, boxes of books in basements, right?
Yeah,
like that.
What are some of the most notable book covers that you've done?
Well, I think you mentioned Chicken Soup, you know, that always comes up. I think back in the day, before it was big, I don't know if you've interviewed...
we interviewed Jennifer.
Jennifer, uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah. How many publishers they had to go to before someone would take it?
Well, you know, yeah.
That was amazing.
Isn't that something? the way these stories go. But,
yeah.
Chicken Soup for the Soul was catching fire. And so Jennifer and Marcy said, you know, you should do another book, like a follow-up book called For the Women's Soul. And he said, that was a great idea. And they pulled me in, along with my wife at that time, Felicity. And we worked with them and came up with the second book, you could say, in the series.
Mm-hmm.
And then quickly followed with Chicken Soup for the Mother's Soul. And by the time, you know, you get around to the second edition, we did a second edition of, I think, Women's Soul. And then by then they'd become so big and they were so busy that, you know, I was out of the loop by then. But ever since, I can always claim, well, I've done some covers that, you know, you've seen like millions, not just thousands. And... So that's been kind of neat.
Well, now the Chicken Soup for the Soul books have mm-hmm. some theme that carries over in right. terms of the cover design, don't they? For each one, there's some similarities? And is that
right.
the cover design that you originated?
Well, not exactly. The very first one was done, Jack had somebody do it, I don't know who. And so there was a style that was established, and yes, we did have to plug in. So that was part of the challenge. In fact, that was part of the fun, was trying to how to make this different from... and yet still fit the mm-hmm. mold. And
right.
They've done it, I don't know, 30 or 40 or 50 or more versions of that ever since.
Yeah, everything but Chicken Soup for the Chickens, I think.
Chickens. Yeah. And I've had my hand in some other books that are that might be names you know. There's one book by Robert Alberti and Michael Emmons called Your Perfect Right. They had already sold over 1 million when they contacted me.
Mm.
And... I'm sure they're doing fine. I was one of their cover designers. You know, they keep redesigning and probably finding new publishers as well. That's kind of a common story. Similar to the Passion Test. You may know about that one, Chris Atwood and Janet.
Janet was our guest about a year ago, I think.
Yeah, I guess
so. What was this?
Well, maybe 3 years now ago, they had me do their cover. And they did make number one on Amazon. And then they were picked up by Viking, who had their own way of doing it from then on. And Janet and Chris really wanted me to continue designing the new cover, but, you know, that's how far that went. So I can't claim what's on the cover now, but back in the first edition.
So when a writer has a book that they've published, either self-published or with a small publisher, and it becomes popular enough to get the attention of a mainstream publisher, mm-hmm. does the second or the subsequent publisher usually want to redesign mm-hmm. the cover?
It's pretty normal. You know, the publisher is the one who's kind of, the buck stops with them. And if they have a style or a method that works for them, they would like to continue with that. There have been times when I've come in and rescued something where, like there's an author whose book is about to be published by a bigger house, and they get the proof and they say, oh no, which team did this one, you know, and at what time of the day? So I have been brought in sometimes, and
wow.
My cover gets used instead, because if the publisher is happy, why not, right? They saw their junior designer, whatever they did, let's say, and then they see mine, and they say, this is fine, it's over, done, we'll run with this. You might know Robert Roth. He's written a number of books. Anyway, there was something about the Natural Law Party back in the 90s.
Okay. Yeah.
That one comes to mind right now. That's a story like that. You might know the Urantia book. Have you heard of that one?
No. What's that one?
It's a 2,000-page esoteric story of the Earth and the universe.
Okay.
Sounds interesting.
It's kind of the gigantic compilation of all the esoteric knowledge you could imagine that actually makes sense if you have a PhD.
Is it fiction or nonfiction?
Well, you decide.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So you have to read the books before you can do the cover, probably.
Unfortunately, that one I could not read before doing the cover. A 2,000-page book, I couldn't get to that.
No.
But, yeah, typically I will. It's a good idea to do.
Oh, I would think so.
You know, it is, because even the author or the publisher might not really... I mean, of course they're close to the book, of course. But my addition to the team can be to bring in a perspective that only I can maybe bring. And mm-hmm. I have shocked people sometimes, clients of mine, with something that they were not at all expecting to see. It's very easy to get into this mode of how it should look, you know. Some things are just obvious. And then I can... Part of my art, my challenge, is to present something that is at the same time familiar. I mean, if it's obtuse, I mean, you're not going to attract anyone.
Right.
But it has to be familiar. But at the same time, it has to be unexpected as well.
And different.
Different, mm-hmm. unexpected. Hopefully you've feel that I've never seen this before. If you have this feeling like I've seen it before, then it's old.
Mm.
And yet you've got to cross that line and be familiar at the same time.
Right. There has to be something that the viewer, a general viewer, can connect with.
Exactly. Well, in general, there's another story there is about demographics.
Sure.
Because a book can be a mega bestseller, but not everybody cares. It's not for everybody.
Right.
It's only for those, like a thriller, say. You mm-hmm. have these runaway bestseller thrillers. And there are plenty of people that would never go near that.
Right.
So what you want to do is, you know, aim it toward the people that you want, the people that would actually respond.
And is there... like research out there that you can consult when someone comes to you with a genre, and that, or is it just based on your experience to know that, you know, this particular genre, the readers like this particular type of cover?
It is that way. It's kind of like you want to fit in. You don't want to look like you're in the wrong category. And at the same time, you want to look like you're superior within the category. So there you go with the we're new, we're better. There are methods to do that, but it does boil down to, how you say, you can have great tools, but it doesn't make you a great whatever you are. Like, you can have all the best gardening tools, but it doesn't make you a good gardener.
No, that's right.
So
you got to get down in the dirt.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, actually, the gardening analogy is a pretty good one, because once you've seen enough seasons and you've seen the trends of how things work, and if you do this, you see a result, It's kind of like that. I mean, after a number of years, you begin to kind of feel that there is a distinct, in fact, difference between what looks, you could say, mediocre and really that stands out, that looks like it's important as compared to just all the others. And that's a difficult thing to explain.
Do you find yourself looking at book covers in a bookstore? I mean, really perusing them, you know?
I'd say peruse is a light word. Yeah, Mary will attest. Any chance I get, I'll go to it. Yes, for me, it's a buffet.
Uh-huh, sure. I
mean, it's research. It is necessary.
Sure. It is.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and not just books, but art, actually. I like to subscribe to art magazines, and they're always so forward-looking, these dedicated mm-hmm. art magazines. And to just see things that turn the crank in ways that I wouldn't see, because if it's on a book cover, it's already done.
True. So,
somebody did that.
Right.
So what's something that people aren't doing, at least there, that maybe I can synthesize and bring in?
Mm-hmm.
So I like to do that. I have different kinds of art in my office, and I like to rotate it in and out. So I am always kind
for
of
stimulation.
Stimulated. Yes, exactly.
So are you an art collector?
Oh, I wouldn't say art collector. You could say I'm an art magazine page terror writer.
Putting up on the wall first.
I do that, yeah. I'll tear the pages out if something strikes me or something like, mm-hmm. whoa, that could work for what?
You know, right.
And it just goes in like a sponge.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Fairfield expert book cover designer George Foster. George, do you have a business name that you use that's other than just George Foster?
I do. Well, I came up with the very original idea, Foster Covers.
Okay. Simple, yet to the point.
When I was getting a website address, you know, mm-hmm. George Foster was taken. I was too late. So I tried George-Foster, on and on and on.
Right.
And I ended up with Foster Covers, and by golly, nobody had that.
Well, good.
So do you have a favorite genre that you like to do especially, to design for? Or?
Gosh, I knew you'd ask that one, and I thought a little about it, and it's difficult. I will say that I get very excited about fiction. I've done a lot of nonfiction. I mean, there's much more nonfiction than fiction that's even published. So I've done a lot of nonfiction, and I bring everything I can to it. But with fiction, there's an emotional aspect to it that is more challenging, I think, generally. There's a publisher who I have worked with since they got started called Ocean View Publishing. They've done, so far, 30 titles. They've only been at it now about 3 years, maybe four. And I've done all their covers.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's an interesting challenge there because I'm trying to make them all look different from what I've done before, you know.
And they're mostly fiction?
Oh, all fiction.
All fiction.
All fiction. In fact, all thrillers and mysteries.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so that's been a lot of fun doing that. But self-help is also a good one. I love self-help because, it's helping people, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are ones that are very profoundly so. Thank God I is an example. I would put that more in the inspiration category.
Yes.
But but there are sometimes when a new client, a publisher, has something that I really feel a personal connection with, that this is really, it's a mission. As you know, I mean, writers are writing from passion.
Either, absolutely.
If you're not writing from your passion, you're not going to finish what you start.
Absolutely.
You know, because it is a challenge, right, to finish a book. So, you know, it doesn't matter who the category is, really. I that's one thing I love about my work is that I'm always working with people who are passionate. I just love that.
Now, in the Thank God I, did you do the book one cover or the book two or both?
Both.
Both.
However, I should say that was by committee. Those covers, I don't mean that in a bad way, but I can't claim, I mean, it's not typically what I would do. It's what I would do when working with a committee.
Okay.
And that happens a lot, too.
I bet.
It happens a lot.
Now, how did that particular one come to you?
Thank God I?
Yes.
I believe that we mentioned John Kramer mm-hmm. earlier, and there's a fellow, John Castagnini, who is the founder of the Thank God I. I like to call it the Thank God I cult. that in a good way, John.
Right.
And he contacted John Kramer to get advice to bring him on the team. And John mentioned me, and, you know, like that. And he's gotten very, very good people on his team.
It's John really has. Interesting because John, what, Casti, what's
Castagnini,
you Castagnini could say. Is not from Fairfield.
No.
But he's made the connection with a whole bunch of Fairfield people.
Mm-hmm.
In that book, and is it just coincidence that?
Well, I will say this. You know, I've lived here a long time, and this town, Fairfield, is really a different kind of a town. For being a small town, there is a lot of creativity here.
Oh my!
A lot, lot. You could say per capita, right?
Yes.
And yes. So there are some, you know, names that come out of this place,
yeah.
And so it's not surprising that there would be a big a showing of Fairfield authors in a New York City, you know, publishing venture.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, how do most of your other clients? How do most of your clients come to you?
It's, you know, word of mouth. I think really there are people in the industry that know me. I've been around a long time, and so people know me and recommend me. I mean, people like say distributors, book distributors, or printers, or there's a thing called a book shepherd. If you know what I mean.
A book shepherd.
Well, yeah.
That's a new,
tell you
new
what,
one.
You should know what a book shepherd is.
Yes.
There are people who have been around the block the entire way, and they can offer themselves as a consultant to somebody who just doesn't know, knows that they don't know, and knows that they will benefit from having somebody hold their hand.
Shepherd them along.
Shepherd, exactly. Right. Yeah. As Mark Twain put it so well, he said, it's important to learn from your experience. But it's much less expensive to learn from someone else's. So anyway, book shepherds, I know a number of them. And so word of mouth is great. It's the best. Oh, and other authors, too. I mean, clients of mine, they'll pass my name.
Now, yeah, I'm curious about the changing publisher thing. I assume you sign a contract with a publisher, and then when that contract is, you sign it for so many months or something, then when that's up, you can change publishers, or how does that work?
Do you mean an author signing?
Yeah, for an author.
Well, an author's relationship with a publisher is a whole other story. My relationship, I'm a freelancer, so I get hired to do my thing, and then I pass the rights, the copyright.
Okay.
Over. So I don't own the copyright, and so it's not like I'm licensing, or there's no royalty attached to what I do. It's, once it's done, it's done. And they can print it forever, everywhere they want, any planet they want.
And for an author, usually what happens if they have if they self-publish, then they can go, you know, to another publisher easily.
Mm-hmm.
But if they've had like a small publisher, what may happen if it takes off is that they have to sort of buy back the rights from that publisher to go to another publisher.
Yeah. Well, people are people, first of all. Yeah. And secondly, they become publishers or authors. And so when it comes to two people coming together, it's always a negotiable thing.
Mm.
Some publishers have it very written in stone, and you have to just fit their model. But depending on who you are and how successful you were, say, with your book, say you self-publish a book, and it's really doing well, then you can cut a different deal with a publisher because they really want you. And then when their contract ends, then, yeah, you can move on or renew, things like that.
And sometimes what happens is a publisher will let a book go out of print, and then the author can get the rights back to mm-hmm. go to another publisher if that publisher does not want to reprint. Although it can be very, very tricky to get the rights back. I've heard some stories that it's out of print, that some of the bigger publishing companies are reluctant to let the rights go,
mm-hmm.
even though they don't want to do it. They don't want to print it again.
We don't want anybody else to have it either. Yeah,
yeah, they want to keep that option.
Yeah.
I have talked with many people who have been published by a big house who were frustrated and felt that they didn't get treated as well as they wanted to. And they decided to self-publish after all.
Mm.
You can go the other way.
Right.
You can start with a signature and a contract and a whole big dream. My God, I'm carried by whoever. And then find out later that, my God, what happened? You know, it's a year later, 2 years. And they decide, you know, I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah.
Probably 75-80% of my clients are self-publishers.
Really?
I was wondering what percentage.
Uh-huh. And the other percent are really really small publishers, not the big guys.
Right, because they have their in-house teams.
Yes, they do. And I don't live there. It's sort of like if you're not there, it's like, who are you? Mm. So, and that's okay. I'm sure there's plenty of passion there. I'm sure of that. But I got to say, I'm up to here with passion with these people that I work with. So I'm happy.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I'm happy with how it is.
And you don't have somebody looking over your shoulder constantly telling you, you know, that you have to do it this way.
Oh, you know, that's interesting. It's true. I encourage everyone I work with to get more input on what I do for them. I produce a proof. This is kind of how it works. I meet with them. I read their book, all that. Get that, the incubation. Come up with what I think is a very, very good, strong, the winner. I present that to them, and then I encourage them to show that around. Because they have a team apart from me, or you could say I'm on their team. And all that input is very useful. Sometimes working with a larger publisher, they'll have a style or a method that might be more, corporate, I guess you might say. And I don't complain. I love it. I mean, it boils down to people. It's just people, whether they're corporate or not. It's just sometimes I found that there are people that are, a slave to the policies that they did not create. And so I can tell.
No flexibility.
Well, I can tell that they're having to work a little bit one or two generations away from where their heart is.
Okay.
You know, and that can be a little less enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Now, what happens if you do a design and you give it to them and the author doesn't like it, or the publisher, whomever is making the decision? Is that difficult for you?
I actually experience that a lot. I try to hit it right on the head. You know, one hammer, one nail, pow. And that can be approved, too. I've seen that a lot, too. But there can be many times when I'm off or somehow, whatever the reason. And we either revise or start over, whatever it takes. It can turn into a lot of versions. There are times, particularly with those thriller mysteries I told you, we sometimes you're just on the head, bingo, and sometimes you're working for can be months.
And do you charge differently if you have to go through a lot of revisions?
Someone told me, a business consultant told me years ago, to turn your, if you have a service business, this is some pretty good wisdom I'll share with you right now. A service business, turn it into a product. If you have a product business, turn that into a service. So in my case, I decided to pick a standard fee, one for everyone. And sometimes I get it done quicker, and sometimes I don't. But I don't want to put that on my client.
Mm.
I don't want to put that on the client. Because what they're getting is what I do, not how long it took.
Right.
Or how many versions it took.
Okay, but some clients are just really, I would imagine, unreasonably picky.
I don't think unreasonably picky. Well, I could understand how someone could interpret picky as unreasonable. But at the same time, I mean, I do respect every second that it's their book.
Mm.
It's not my book. At the end of the day, they're the one with that book to sell.
Yeah.
And I could say, oh, but I wanted it this way. I mean, what? I'm going to be chasing after them and saying, you should have done it my way. I do my best shot, and then they can accept it or not.
They have to be happy with it in order for you to be happy with it.
Well, and they have to be happy with it in order to be, enthusiastic about selling
it. And they're the ones that are going to be selling it.
Exactly. They're the ones who are throwing the ball as far as they can. And if they feel somehow apologetic or somehow limp about this packaging of their book, I mean, it would throw water on it every single time.
I think I would could possibly have a problem if I were a client coming to you and you gave me something and maybe it wasn't exactly what I wanted, but I wouldn't want to hurt your feelings. And so I might say, say yes, and then it wasn't exactly what I wanted. Do you think that might happen occasionally?
It might. Well, if it does, I'm not wise
enough
to see.
You don't,
well,
yeah.
My client, I don't see my clients face to face typically.
Ah.
You interviewed Thomas Gates last week.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually, I'm working with him.
Right.
And but that's a rarity that somebody in town is my client. I typically am on the phone or emails. So if somebody wants to write me a polite email saying, well, this will do fine, thank you,
you don't,
then all I can do is take it as
right.
it says.
Oh, and that might, that's, it probably is better that way, because if you were working, you know, back, putting myself back in that position, I might be less hesitant to be critical of something done by someone I didn't know than of someone that I've known for years.
Well, and also I should point out, I tell people when it's the first time we're working together that I can take it. I lost my ego in 1978 in the spring in my illustration class.
All you want to tell us that story?
All 20 of us got our egos thoroughly beaten out of us in that one semester in the spring of 78. And at the end of that semester, we all had a laugh about it, that we can take anything now.
Where was that?
Oh, that was in Columbus, Ohio, at the Columbus College of Art and Design.
Wow.
Yeah, I got a BFA there. I went in thinking I would be a cartoonist and came out thoroughly confused.
Ah, okay.
Well, not thoroughly confused. I came out thinking I would be a watercolor painter.
So,
no.
You know,
that's a switch.
We hear a lot about, particularly in writing workshop, you know, university settings, people, the instructors being just really cruel and critical, and I think in art school situations too. It sounds like you're saying that there may be some benefit to that.
Oh, I'll tell you, that particular school, I'll never forget the first day, Monday morning, freshman year, this fellow comes out and it was in a theater, an auditorium. And he's walking across the stage slowly with a very stern look on his face. And he's saying, I know all of you. I know where you've come from. You, each and every one, and he was right, each and every one of you were the star of your high school art class. And we're all sitting there going, holy cow. And he says, here, you're not that anymore.
Mm.
And, you know, people were dropping out. It was like two or three a week were dropping out for like the first month.
Really?
It was so scary that, oh my God, I thought I was going to be a rock star.
Because
I was in high school.
Yeah.
And then you get to this new, you know.
And everybody's a rock star.
Everybody's,
or would be rock star.
It's sort of like the army, you know. Like you think you used to be special. You're not special here.
Wow.
We're going to tear you down and rebuild you. And I gained a lot from art school. In fact, I recommend it. If somebody wants to be a book cover designer, they have to be an artist. I mean, sorry, but there are a lot of people who are designing. I mean, I deal with this because people are a publisher and they have their cover done by somebody who knows software. And it looks like the software did it. It doesn't look like an artist knew what they were doing, right?
Right.
So, you know, a gardener has the tools. It doesn't make you a gardener.
Right.
So I think that those who came up as an artist first can use the tools.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is George Foster, who has designed over 1,000 book covers in the last, 15
years?
Yeah,
something like that. Yeah.
Wow.
That's a lot.
I'm just warming up.
You know, it's interesting. I notice a lot of, you know, I see a lot of books, I see a lot of self-published books, and I can usually tell the difference just immediately when I pick up a book, whether it's self-published or not. And sometimes it's by the cover, but it's often by the type inside. Do you get involved in typeset design with your clients at all?
I always encourage my clients to get that done. I don't do that. I've done a number of them, I mean, interiors, back years ago, and I enjoy it, but I think my gift more is about the marketing part, more of the splash on the front. But the interior, yes, I know what you mean.
It's a subtle difference, but it's so obvious to me.
Yeah. It's one of those things that somebody might not know why they're rejecting the book in their mind on that first impression level. They might not know why, but they just know they are rejecting it.
Mm-hmm.
And it can start with the cover, certainly. But you can have a good cover, and then you look inside and you go, oh my God, it looks like Microsoft Word.
Yeah.
And you know what that does? It cheapens everything.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like they didn't take this all the way.
Yeah.
So they didn't take their content all the way either.
What about chapter plates, you know, the headings of chapters are little things, you know. Do you do that as well?
Well, on occasion, I've been asked to provide that kind of a thing. But again, it doesn't come up often. I just prefer to recommend very good people who do that and specialize in that.
Okay. Now, do you do children's books?
I've done some. Those kind of design themselves, because a children's book typically has illustrations.
Right.
And the illustrator typically will be represented on the cover. They'll either do something for the cover, or they will, or will take something from the inside and put it on the cover. So not many, maybe half a dozen.
Well, you know, just because somebody is a good children's book illustrator, I don't think that necessarily makes them the a good cover designer.
Oh, good point. Yes. And art is only art. And graphic design is a whole other thing.
So even if you've got the, you know, a really fantastic illustrator, it might be worth coming to someone like you to put the finishing touches on the cover.
To how to arrange it in a way that looks like, again, it was professionally done. You can have something that looks homegrown. And by the way, that has a charm of its own. But if you want to swim in the bigger waters, you need to get past those gatekeepers and the distributors, reviewers, retailers, and you need to impress them, not just hope that you'll get your book out, but you actually have to sort of pass through some gates. And they look at covers every day, dozens every day, and they have to make decisions quickly, and they do. And because they do, you have to have a good one.
Yeah, they don't. So they don't spend a lot of time looking at a lot of different covers.
Well, there, I've run into this. Or some people might have an illusion that, I mean, their book is going to be read by these gatekeepers, and they'll see the merit of the book, but they don't read the book.
They look at the cover.
Yeah, they do. In fact, the reps who go to the bookstore chains and say, "Here's our latest, you know, offerings for the fall or something," they don't bring the books. They bring the covers.
Oh, of course, they don't want to carry all those books around.
It's silly. Well, and who's going to read them? I mean, you bring a stack that weighs 500 pounds. I mean, no, you just bring a stack like this high of a bunch of covers, and you just
now. Say, it's not just the front cover, right?
Right.
The back cover, too?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. There's a 1-2-3 kind of a step at a point of purchase. If somebody's browsing books and making decisions like about books, you know, am I attracted or not? The front cover is like the merchant in the marketplace yelling out one word, like, rugs. And you walk up to him and you say, rugs? And he goes, and he won't shout at you now. He'll talk. And so, like, for me, the front cover is like that one word. And you've flagged somebody. And then the back cover is the next step, typically. You flip it to the back. Now they're talking to you in normal tones and telling you about, you know, our book is this and it's that, and you're going to get this from it, and you're going to benefit by this, and all of these things. And so you've been stopped. That was the biggest job. Now that you've stopped, you'll, okay, I can read this, or I'll scan it anyway. Maybe I'll scan a few bullet points, or maybe I'll look at the bio and there's the author's photo. Do I trust that person? Things like that. So the back cover is very, very important. It's not a throwaway item at all.
Yeah.
Not to mention the spine.
Oh, yes.
Skinny little thing, right?
Right. In a store, that may be all you see.
No kidding. It's a sea of spines. You walk into a bookstore.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a sea of spines. If you get your book faced out, by the way, here's a little tip. Another tip number two for authors, if you're reading or reading what?
Listening.
Listening, thank you. Is there are these little clubs that get formed. Authors around the country, and they're all friends, and they'll go to their local bookstores, and say you have, say, 10 friends. I don't know if I'll get in trouble for saying this, but you can go into a bookstore and look up your friend's books, pull them out, put them face out on the shelf. And then you have your friends around the country doing that for your book.
So. Well, you know, I know this is true, because when I go to a store, you know, you have to go like this, to look at the
She's
title.
Tipping her head sideways.
Yeah. You know, and it's very uncomfortable for me. Well, I have chronic vertigo, and it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I will have to pull the book out and look at it.
Yeah. The spine is a sticky little thing. It's so small, and it has such a big job. One little technique you can do on a spine is, if you've got a book that is only so many pages, try to make the page count a little wider. are bigger. You make the page count a little more, and that's a function of printing. You can pick a thicker paper. You can make your book size a little smaller so that the same amount of words
fill up more pages.
A wider book, yeah, with a smaller trim size.
So your spine is wider.
Yeah, yeah. If you can get a little wider, then you've got a little more visual billboard power on a shelf. You know,
lots of tricks to the trade, aren't there?
Well, you know, you do what you can.
Well, how much time would you say you spend on designing the front cover versus the back and the spine?
If it took me a year, I'd say about the first 11 and a half months are spent on the front.
Interesting.
And, yeah, and then the back, well, once you've got the front established, then the back follows pretty naturally. And it's good to tie it together, the theme. Visual theme. So it feels like this, you know, fully integrated, fully baked package.
Do you give any advice on the copy that's on the back?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
In fact, there's often a picture, of course, of the author.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, I call it like a descending order of priority, that everything that you can say about the book, I want to have all of that. And then we pick whatever is going to be the strongest. Like if you have an endorsement from some household name, and it's a very strong endorsement, not just some faint praise.
Mm-hmm.
Bingo. That might even go on the front cover.
Right.
But on the back, there are these... basically, you know, here's the thing. The front cover is about the emotional decision to make. If you've made that emotional decision in a positive way, then you turn it over. You look at the back. If you've made a decision against the book, you're not going to go to the back cover. So once you're on that back cover, then the mind, the left brain, the non-emotional part, kind of wants to agree with the emotional decision that's been made. It wants to justify the decision. So that's where you get all verbal now. You say things like, you know, the best book on the topic that you've ever read. You know, I know there's 100 million of these books on this topic, but this is different because... You know the term elevator pitch?
Yes.
That's the back cover. How long do you have to read? Not long, right? So you can say a lot in a short time. I mean, we're only talking a few inches.
Right.
So, and you don't want to say so much that the type gets so small that nobody's going to even bother.
That's true.
So you have to edit. And I do a lot of editing of back cover text because I get a lot of text where somebody says, I did this and I said that and, you know, we and all that. And I'll take all those out and put in you, your, you know. We're not talking to the masses. We're talking to one person at a time on the back of a book. One person is reading that quietly to themselves. And if you're speaking to them, they go past the back cover and say, you know, I like this. And then they'll look inside. And then if they see it looking like, you know, Microsoft Word, then it's like, oh.
Now, what about, like, particularly with hardcover where you've got the flap, the jacket flap? Is that part of what you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, the flap as well. That you get, obviously, more space for selling. Right.
Right.
You can move the bio and the picture to the back flap, which is usual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And on the inside front flap, you can do things like or tell a synopsis, you know, something very attractively written, or you can pull an excerpt, too. Whatever works the best. Again, it's like all of these things you can do. You can put
which need a hook of some kind there.
Some reason to keep moving forward. Some reason that makes your head nod up and down while you're looking further and deeper into this book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then typically, I mean, you'll go to the price. Does this price look like it's a good price? I had one client who priced his book 3 times higher than his, you know, other, what you could say, comrades in that category. And he insisted, probably still does, that his book is that much better than the other books. But you know what? Barnes & Noble would not carry his book on the shelf. They carried it online, but shelf space is precious. And they said, your book won't sell. I mean, why would they buy your book for 3 times the cost when there's, you know, 3 or 4 other titles, similar topic to you, at a third of the cost? You know, and he insisted, and they were wrong, and he insisted, and they wouldn't carry it. So I counsel people that way about the price, you know, try to fit in that way too.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is George Foster, who's really giving us quite an education about book cover design.
Well, in today's economy, you have to really think about that. Well, are you going to price your book?
Oh, on pricing the book, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Well, there's something called the Rule of Nine. I don't think I'll go into it deeply here, but yeah, by the way, if listeners have questions or want to talk to me at all, they're welcome to email me. I've got a website, fostercovers.com. So, you know.
And your email is available. They can get your email on that.
It's very easy to click me from there rather than give you a lot more. Well, okay, it's George at
fostercovers.com.
Right, no big surprise.
You know, that's an easy thing to remember, though. Mm. Foster Covers.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
I like that.
It's better than some. Someday I'll, who knows. But the Rule of Nine is about pricing your book. And if you want to know more about it, maybe just email me or something like mm-hmm. that.
Now you have intrigued us.
Yeah, no kidding.
I'll tell you this much. I can maybe summarize it in a brief way. The price of a book to produce, I mean, just as a unit, as an inventory unit, it has a cost.
Right.
You print 1,000, it'll cost you so much per book. You print 3,000, it'll cost less per book. You know how that works.
Right.
And so you project how many books, not the first print run, by the way, because the first print run is... how you say, it's your ticket into the stadium. I mean, you have all these upfront expenses, like the cover design, for example, or the interior design, things like this. You have to do all these things in order to get the book ready. Once it's printed, you have your first print run. That's your experiment. How am I doing? Second print run, which you would need to project, of course, ahead. If I print 3,000 and they're going to cost me, say, $1.25 a book, or say, let's say $1. Let's say it's $1 just for simple. I'm not a math guy. Let's say it's $1 a book. So what you can do is you can project your price should be, ideally, 9 times that.
Mm.
Because by the time you account for the distributor's take and the retailer's cut and all these things, mm-hmm. you want to sell your book at a profit.
Right.
So if you can mark it up 9 times, you're going to do well.
Now, how does print-on-demand change... change that, and also does it change you what you do at all if you know a book's going to be print on demand rather than a print run?
Well, you know, print on demand thankfully is getting better and better. I was doing this before print on demand was around, and printing was more of a craft, much more of a storied craft. Now it's more just pushing buttons, or at least these print on demand publishers are like that. Just
right.
You print the button and it'll be done. The quality is not quite what it is compared to traditional offset, but the advantages are obvious. That if I can get 50 copies or 100 copies, that's very attractive. Now they're going to cost more per copy,
but I'm not going to have a garage full of boxes.
I've put out less money,
right?
And so it's one of those trade-offs. Now the thing is, if you're going ahead and reordering, say 100 copies quite often. Then
maybe you should switch to to doing a traditional print run.
Yeah, in fact, if you're going to print more than, say, I don't know, 500, then it makes sense to start talking to a traditional offset, because certainly at 1,000 copies, then there I don't even know anymore where the tipping point would be between print on demand or traditional offset. But as far as the cost per unit, you know,
right?
But the probably changes every year. But then you can really do well with traditional offset. And by then you know, these are selling. So I'll print
now, would
a lot.
You do anything different in your design if you know that something is going to be print on demand?
Not really. The only thing that you sacrifice are, you might call them effects, special effects, like foil stamping.
Mm.
You know what I mean by that.
Right.
Foil stamping or embossing.
Like the Caldecott metal thing mm-hmm. that might be on a... on a book cover or something like that.
There are effects that you can add, or you design totally into the cover, which is the best. Not just stick it on,
right.
but actually mm-hmm. design with that in mind. There are finishes, though, that you can add. Like, you've probably seen covers that have, they're very matte finished, and yet some of it is very glossy.
Mm. Right.
On the same cover. That's a very inexpensive way to add.
Like the title, for instance, would be probably.
Yeah, could have, say, a shine uh-huh. added to it. Right.
Uh-huh.
So that's a neat effect, and it doesn't cost much, but you don't get that with print-on-demand.
Now, do you have to take into consideration the cost of executing a design when you're designing?
Me, personally, there are people who who do, who have to think about things like photo shoots or hiring illustrators.
Mm-hmm.
You know, budgets come into play. Those are more, I think, in the New York houses where they are producing like, you know, 75 books every time they roll out of bed. And they have budgets, they have big business plans, and lots of designers. And so they have budget managers, and they say, your budget, this book is a big one. We think this will be big. So you've got a bigger budget. And then they can think about, okay, well, I've been waiting to work with this photographer, and so now I can call him because there was something he did that would work here. But if there's going to be big bucks involved,
right,
like that, that's not my world. My world is, do you know the term stock photography?
Mm-hmm. But it's, maybe explain it, because not everyone might know.
Well, photographers shoot photographs, of course, and they either sell it one at a time, like, you know, you hire me to photograph something, or I can upload my photographs en masse to stock photography websites where they can be sold at much cheaper levels, but a lot of people can buy them, so it tends to work. So I have that kind of access. Now, the thing is, you don't want to just plug and play. You don't just take a picture and stick it on a cover and call it done. At least, I don't think so.
Right.
It's a starting point. It's an inspiration. It might be the cornerstone for a cover, but it doesn't mean you're just plugging in a picture and saying, oh, isn't that pretty?
But doesn't, I mean, the cost of printing the book, is that going to be affected by how you design it? And so sometimes do you have a situation where an author says, I can't afford a four-color cover, I can only afford two colors, something like that?
I see. You're showing your age.
That's not the case anymore?
You know, yeah. I was a graphic designer in the days when I would pray for a four-color assignment sometimes. I would pray for four-color because it was so exotic for me back in the 80s, 90s. And then the printing has... In fact, you know, it's funny, actually. I did a cover for a guy years ago, and he contacted me just a couple weeks ago, and his cover was a two-color cover back in the day when your local print shop, you know, it would cost you per ink. And he says, it's time for a revision. He's a PhD now, so he said, I want you to add PhD to my name and send me back the file. And, you know, I converted it from a two-color to a four because I could be wrong. I don't think I'm wrong, that it's actually cheaper now to print full color than it is to print two PMS colors. PMS, by the way, means Pantone Matching System. Just so you know, Pantone is a color company.
Right, right.
And but two Pantone colors on an ink, you know, on the ink rollers, I think would probably
be more expensive.
I'll take a risk. I think definitely cost more for his cover. So I sent it to him as a four color cover.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there aren't anything like the number of photographs you use,
nope,
or there's nothing like that that you have budgetary constraints on when
nope
you design a cover.
Nope. It's just so many square inches and whatever you want to do. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
Full color. There's one I did lately. I got to tell you though. This is a little different. Maybe on the website you'll see it. Richard Rohr. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a best-selling author in the Catholic area. But his writings transcend Christianity as such, as a book category, because he covers such wide topics. He's coming straight from the Catholic perspective, but he appeals to many people. So he's enjoying a best-selling kind of status. And he has a new book coming out later this year called The Naked Now. And it's kind of about the third eye from the point of view of the Catholic perspective. So I designed a cover for him that, what a title. I mean, how do you design that?
Yeah, really.
and the subtitle is, I may get this wrong, but I think it's How to See as the Mystics See.
Mm.
So how naked can you make this cover? And I think I pulled it off. Mary was nearby. And she came in while I was just getting started, and I always start with white, just because that's what I got in the Photoshop. Always start there, and I laid in some type, and it was gray. It just happened to be a gray, a light gray. Mm-hmm. And I typed it in, and it was temporary for the moment. But she came in and went, wow.
So are you saying this is the fastest cover you have ever done?
Oh, you know, that's a good point. Well, you know, ironically, I parked that version and rolled up my sleeves and did my usual muscle flexing, and I tried all kinds of other things first.
And then you came back to it.
And she just kept coming back.
Well, we only have a few minutes left this afternoon, believe it or not. And we did want to ask Mary about her contribution to Thank God I. Do you want to come up to the mic here? And
But don't go away,
George, because here, if she can just get near you and and talk into the mic.
There you are.
So how did you come to be a contributing author to this book?
Well, when we met John Castagnini in New York City, we were at the Book Expo in New York City. It's frequently held there. And we went, and we set up a meeting with John, and we were talking with him. And this is in the initial concepts that he had, you know, and now he's talking to his cover designer here, and it was pretty much hired George on the spot once he actually met him in person. And so, you know, we just got talking, and I said, you know, I really love to write. And he said, well, why don't you submit something and see, and what would your topic be? So I had all these different ideas, you know, of different things that have happened in my life that were misfortunes or unfortunate experiences that somehow become something that you feel so much gratitude for, which you can't imagine.
At
you know,
time,
some of the titles the time, of the right. stories that are in these books.
I know.
So what is your title?
Mine is Thank God My Father Died When I Was 4.
Oh, my. Wow.
And so I just introduced myself as this little child and what happened surrounding my father's death and then the rest of my life without him, what it was like.
Oh.
And how I learned things that generally you would learn with a father around that I learned without him. You know, how to use a hammer and power tools and things like that. So,
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about it.
Boy, I wish
we are out of time.
Right.
Thank you so much for being with us today, George. We've learned an incredible amount.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, we'll have to do this again.
Really?
And we will close, as usual, with a quote from Mom.
You know, feeling gratitude and not expressing it is like wrapping a present and not giving it.
See you next week on Writer's Voices, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.